I'm going to have a lot to think about this morning. I want to just dive right in because we have a long way to go, a lot to cover. I don't know if you noticed or not, it kind of dawned on me last week that today is another day that will live in infamy. It's the 15th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on 9/11. And it's such an infamous day. All you have to do is say 9/11 and people know exactly what you're talking about. And so I want us to take a few minutes here to remember that day and remember especially the bravery that was on display to us that day.
September 11th, 2001. A day of grief. A day of courage. This is how that day unfolded.
My daughter called me. She said, plane just flew into the World Trade Center. I said, nah, you gotta be kidding. It's gotta be a Piper Cub or some clown was flying down the river.
At 8:46 a.m., American Airlines Flight 11 from Boston, with 92 aboard, traveling at a speed of 470 miles per hour, strikes the North Tower of the World Trade Center complex. Within minutes, officials coordinate the citywide emergency response. Their base of operations is a state-of-the-art command center located on the 23rd floor of 7 World Trade Center. With one tower in flames, the tragedy is only beginning. It is 9:03 when United Airlines Flight 175, with 65 aboard, traveling at the speed of 590 miles per hour, smashes into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. This aircraft strikes the corner of the South Tower. It rips a diagonally shaped gash from the 84th to the 78th floors. The South Tower lasts only 56 minutes before it succumbs at 9:59 a.m. A dust cloud billows outward for blocks. Victims stagger away. At 10:28, the television mast atop the North Tower spears straight down.
Once the collapse started, there really wasn't any way to stop it. It was just going to go all the way down once it got started.
Chaos in New York City. Power is down in Lower Manhattan. Phone lines jammed with more than 230 million calls. Hundreds of firefighters trapped in the towers. Hundreds more race to the scene. Falling debris from the collapse of the North and South Towers ignites fires in the neighboring buildings of the World Trade Center. World Trade 4, 5, and 6 are ablaze. World Trade 7, the building housing the city's command center, burns unchecked for 7 hours. At 5:20, it collapses. The city's emergency nerve center is destroyed.
Somewhere in that time, and it's very hard to keep track of time during this, they had been ordered to evacuate number 7 by the Port Authority. To this day, we don't know who gave that order, but whoever it was saved a lot of people's lives.
With New York a war zone, some residents walk across the Brooklyn Bridge to get out of the city. Others seek escape in vessels piloted by the Army Corps of Engineers. At 7:45 p.m., the New York Police Department says 78 officers are missing and estimates that 200 firefighters are dead. At 10:56 p.m., police officials say they believe there are victims alive in the rubble of the World Trade Center.
working with urban search and rescue teams, there was a lot of areas to be searched underneath the debris field. There were voids that had to be searched for possible live people.
September 11th, 2001, the longest and most tragic day in New York's history, is drawing to a close.
You know, over 3,000 people were killed in the attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., including more than 400 police officers and firefighters who bravely ran toward the chaos instead of away from it. I remember watching on live TV as that second plane plowed into the South Tower, and then as both towers crashed down, thinking, oh, man, there's 10,000 people in those buildings, and usually there were, and somehow, miraculously, most of them managed to escape, and it's a miracle that more lives were not lost that day than were. And I just heard on the History Channel that every boat in the harbor there turned to and were able to rescue and evacuate 500,000 people across the harbor. It's just a phenomenal feat that they were able to pull off. And I remember our country was just horrified by the scope of the destruction. And we did our best to get our minds around the why of it all. You know, why did this happen to us? Why did some people who were in the tower survive, but others who had escaped the towers were killed? People who didn't even believe in God invoke God in an attempt to make sense of the suffering that was caused by those attacks. We have been blessed with such prosperity and security for so long and to such a degree that when this kind of thing hits, it really staggers us. And we experienced on September 11th, 2001, a very, very small taste of what Job experienced as an individual. And Keller says there is there's nothing more inevitable in life than suffering. Most of us have suffered in the past. Some of you are in the middle of suffering right now. And if you're not suffering right now, you will in the future. On that you can count. And I think this message is probably going to have the most meaning to those of you who are in the crucible of suffering at the moment, at this time. But we will all experience suffering sometime during our lives, so it might be wise to take notes if you're not there yet. Suffering is inevitable, and that's why we're doing this series on the book of Job. Today we're going to look at chapter 28, the wisdom chapter. And before we dive into the text, I want to share some of John Walton's introductory comments from the NIV application commentary on the book of Job. He writes, "We should not mistakenly think about that this book is just about Job. It is about all of us. Though the book does engage in extremes, it's not trying to minimize anyone's suffering in comparison. For suffering cannot be measured objectively. Regardless of where anyone's experience fit in on the spectrum of pain and suffering, and that doesn't have to be just physical pain. It can also be emotional pain, relational pain. He says we are all prone to ask the same questions." You know, I don't know how it happens, but have you ever been in one of those conversations that somehow devolve into, well, my pain was worse than yours? This was really predominant when we were still in our childbearing years, and somehow we'd have a couples get together, and somehow the conversation would go to, well, my labor was 12 hours. Yeah, well, mine was 20. Yeah, mine was 4 weeks. You know, it's like one up on that, who hurt the most? But no matter the degree or the type of suffering or the difficulties that you are enduring or will endure in the future, the book of Job is for and about all of us. And he goes on, the book of Job is not about Job, his friends, or the challenger, that is Satan. It is about all of us, and ultimately, it's about God. Our questions about suffering inevitably lead to God, for when we go through difficult times in life, there's no one else to question. He is the one whose ways we seek to understand. When we ask, why me? We are, in effect, asking, how does God work? We may start out asking why we deserve this, but ultimately the question we arrive at is, what kind of God are you? In all our difficult experiences, eventually we arrive at the place where it is no longer us, but God who is on trial. The book of Job explores the difficult question, what is God's relationship to human suffering? But it really doesn't answer the question. Instead, the book of Job invites us to trust God's wisdom and his character. And that's a key word that you will hear throughout this message, the word trust. Walton continues, he says, because the book is about God, the teaching that is offered is valuable to all of us. It does not tell us why Job or any of us suffer, but it does tell us a bit about how we should think about God when we are suffering. This is what we really need to know anyway. And then he says, the purpose of Job is to explore God's policies with regard to the suffering of the world, especially by the righteous or the innocent. In the process, it seeks to revolutionize our thinking about God and the way that he runs the world. Most importantly, the book shifts our attention from the idea that God's justice is foundational to the operation of the world. And by that, he talks about what he calls the retribution principle. And I think we all fall into the trap of thinking in those terms of retribution. And it goes like this. We start thinking that, well, if I'm wise and I'm good, then I will get success and I'll be rewarded. You know, in a way, we start thinking, well, I've been good, I've done this, I've been wise. And in a way, we start thinking, maybe God owes us a reward. But if we're evil and stupid, disaster and punishment comes our way. You know, that becomes a real problem when I'm wise and good and I get disaster instead of reward. And that's what Job's wrestling with. You know, if I'm driving 50 miles an hour in a 25-mile zone and a cop pulls me over and gives me a ticket, well, okay, I get that. But if I'm driving 25 in a 25-mile zone and I get pulled over and get a ticket, it's like, whoa, what's going on here? That's unjust. And that's what Job's struggling with. And Walton says, our thinking about God must shift to the alternative that God's wisdom is the more appropriate foundation. It does not offer a reason for suffering. It does not try to defend God's justice. It does not answer the why question that we are so prone to ask when things go wrong. Instead, we are to trust God's wisdom and in the process to conclude by faith that he is also just, that he is also good. So the book of Job is really leading us to a paradigm shift in our understanding of God. So let's get into the chapter. And there is some disagreement among commentators, but I agree with John Walton that chapter 28 functions as an interlude in the book, and it's inserted by the narrator. These aren't Job's words. This is the narrator inserting this thought, this hymn on wisdom. And it acts as a pivot between the dialogues between Job and his friends in chapters 3 through 27, and the speeches that are to follow between, you know, from Job and Elihu and God that follow this chapter in chapters 29 to 31. And Walton calls chapter 28 a wisdom hymn. And it subtly indicates that we have yet to hear wisdom from any of the men who were characterized as the best of ancient Near Eastern thought. And there are three major stanzas to the hymn. The first stanza is verses 1 through 11. Where we read, there's a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Mortals put an end to darkness. They search out the farthest recesses for ore in the blackest darkness. Far from human dwellings, they cut a shaft in places untouched by human feet. Far from other people, they dangle and sway. And he's referring there to the practice of hanging from ropes or cages to descend deep into the depths of the earth in mining. He says the earth from which food comes, the topsoil up there, is transformed below as by fire. Lapis lazuli, which is a blue gemstone, comes from its rocks, and its dust contains nuggets of gold. No bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion prowls there. People assault the flinty rock with their hands and lay bare the roots of the mountains. They tunnel through the rock. Their eyes see all its treasures. They search the sources of the river and bring hidden things to light. I moved to Wyoming in 1980, and I worked for a company that warehoused and hauled chemicals to drilling rigs that were looking for oil in the overthrust area of the Rocky Mountains. One of the rigs that we serviced sat at 10,000 feet above sea level. The drill bit was 5,000 feet below sea level. It was almost 3 miles below the surface of the earth. The writer is saying here that people know where to find silver. We know how to refine gold. We know how to extract precious metals and gems from deep within the earth. People know how to find oil miles below the earth's surface. But where can wisdom be found? And the point of this first stanza is that people have made some remarkable discoveries. But as one writer noted, humans may be clever, even ingenious and wealthy, but they are rarely wise. The second stanza is in verses 12 through 19. This section begins with two rhetorical questions that really draw our attention to something that is even more valuable and more inaccessible than the treasures that are discovered by human innovation and effort, and that is wisdom. And he says, but where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? No mortal comprehends its worth. And a better word there in place of the word worth would be place, I think. The New Living Translation, I think, gets it right. No one knows where to find it. No mortal comprehends the place of wisdom. It cannot be found in the land of the living. And the land of the living here is a phrase that's very similar to the phrase under the sun in Ecclesiastes, and it's a reference to life on earth or life in the natural realm. And verse 14 says, the deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not with me. See, the deep and the sea are the most inaccessible places in the land of the living. And although we desire to acquire wisdom, it is not possible to find it by human effort or technology. I saw a commercial, a Vonage commercial yesterday, and according to the commercial, we have mastered the far reaches of outer space. We've mastered nanotechnology. We invent chemistry, and we can clone sheep. Human ingenuity can and has accomplished a lot, but it cannot find wisdom. He goes on to say in verse 15, wisdom cannot be bought, can't be found, it can't be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed out in silver. It cannot be bought with the gold of Ophir, with precious onyx or lapis lazuli. Neither can gold nor crystal can compare with it, nor can it be had for jewels of gold. Coral and jasper are not worthy of mention. The price of wisdom is beyond rubies. The topaz of Cush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. See, if you had all the riches of the world at your disposal, you still could not buy wisdom. All the gold and silver and gems in the land of the living are nothing. They are worthless compared to wisdom. I've noticed that the amount of wealth that has been created and the scientific and technological advances made in just my lifetime is really staggering. But none of it will help us get wisdom. None of it will help us answer the why question. Not only is wisdom the most valuable thing in life, it is also the most inaccessible. It cannot be found in the land of the living, and it cannot be bought. So what is this wisdom that he's talking about? A simple definition, wisdom is understanding how things work. The wisdom being addressed here is how the universe and even life itself works. It's competency with regard to all of the complexities of life. And in Proverbs 3, verses 19 and 20, we read, "By wisdom the Lord founded the earth. By understanding he created the heavens. By his knowledge the deep fountains of the earth burst forward, and the dew settles beneath the night sky." See, Job here is he's struggling to make sense of his experiences and to understand how God and the world work, which is way beyond the scope of his perspective or his ability to grasp, even if God did explain it to him. I think that's the point that God makes when he shows up in the storm in chapter 38, verses 1 and 2. "Then the Lord answered Job from the whirlwind, 'Who is this that questions my wisdom with such ignorant words?'" In verses 4 through 7, he says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you know so much. Who determined its dimensions and stretched out the surveying line? What supports its foundations, and who laid its cornerstone as the morning stars sang together with all the angels shouted for joy?" Then in verses 17 and 18, he says, "Do you know where the gates of death are located? Have you seen the gates of utter gloom? Do you realize the extent of the earth? Tell me about it if you know." See, what Job wants is a vantage point from which God, the world, and his own circumstances make sense. But that is out of reach in the land of the living. And Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9 explain why. God speaking says, "My thoughts are nothing like your thoughts, says the Lord. And my ways are far beyond anything you could imagine. For just as the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." When disaster strikes, or when we're buried in troubles and difficulties, we want to know why. We want wisdom. We want God's vantage point and his understanding. In fact, we need for things to make sense. You know, why did those particular people happen to be on those four flights on September 11th, 2001? Why am I sick and not recovering? Why can't I get over this thing? Why did I lose my job? I didn't do anything wrong. And sadly, the search, and oftentimes it's even a demand to understand the reason we suffer, is a fool's errand. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The third stanza, verses 20 through 28. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? And there's a subtle change that happens between verse 12 and verse 20. Verse 12 asks the question, where can wisdom be found? And it says it can't. But in verse 20, the question is, where does wisdom come from? It can't be found because, verse 21, it's hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds in the sky. Destruction and death say only a rumor of it has reached our ears. So even a seance isn't going to help you figure things out. Verse 23, though, God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells. He alone knows where it can be found. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. His perspective is not limited like ours is. And verse 25, when he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. And he said to man, he said to the human race, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. So how can we receive the wisdom to get through suffering and difficulties, especially those that don't make sense? Verse 28 tells us the fear of the Lord is the pathway to wisdom. Now, it's interesting how different people define the fear of the Lord, especially in this context. Tim Keller calls the fear of the Lord a scary level trust that God is loving you, even though it doesn't feel that way. That God is loving you, even though everything around you seems dark. The fear of the Lord is a scary level unconditional trust that God loves you in spite of how it looks. The fear of the Lord is that is wisdom, is unconditionally trusting that God is wise and that he knows what he's doing and he is good. C.S. Lewis illustrated the fear of the Lord in the Chronicles of Narnia. There's a line in there where someone asks, is Aslan safe? And the response is, safe? Whoever said anything about him being safe? Of course he's not safe, but he is good. The fear of the Lord, according to John Walton, involves trusting that God can take all of the pain and devastation that might occur in our lives and bring good from it. That does not make the pain and devastation good. The fear of the Lord involves thinking in terms of trusting his wisdom and loving him. He does care for us and experiences our pain along with us. And then he asks a very important question. He asks, can we acquire an understanding of the wisdom that underlies the cosmic system? Job 28 says no. And remember, the reason why, we just read it in Isaiah 55. My thoughts are nothing like your thoughts. My ways are far beyond anything you could imagine. Just as the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. The ability to create the universe and life itself with all its complexities and establish its orderly operation is what we might call ultimate wisdom. And God alone possesses it and understands it. Verse 23. We are not able, and thank God we're not asked to understand it, but we are invited to partake of the wisdom that is expressed in fearing the Lord. This is different from the fruitless search for ultimate wisdom that was described in verses 20 and 21, in that it requires that we believe, it requires that we trust that God is wise, that he knows what he's doing and where it's all leading, even if we do not get an explanation that makes sense to us. Someone has said, it is wise for us to believe that God is wise. And this becomes a matter of trust rather than understanding. And Walton adds, adopting such a posture does not require us to affirm that there's a reason for, even though I don't know what it is. Instead, it asks us to move beyond reasons. Our confidence is not that there is an explanation. Our confidence is in God's wisdom and his character. He is good and he loves us beyond measure, even if it doesn't look like it or feel like it at the moment. And he goes on to say, we express fear of the Lord when we trust him with our circumstances, as uncomfortable and as confusing as they may be. We trust him enough to accept that there need not be an explanation. We trust that his just nature is unassailable, even though there's no identifiable justice in the circumstances in which we find ourselves. We trust that he has set up the system in the very best, the wisest way possible, even when we're suffering the consequences of a system broken by the fall. We trust his love for us, and we trust that even in our difficulties, he can show his love and strengthen us through the trials. Well, what is the path to wisdom? If we can't find it, we can't buy it, how then can we receive it? I think the first thing to begin with, we must accept the fact that wisdom is not open to us. Ultimate wisdom is not open to us. God alone knows where it dwells. Again, verse 23. Although ultimate wisdom is not accessible to us, even in the Bible, God has made a pathway to wisdom available to us as we fear Him and as we submit to His wisdom and turn aside from evil. What does that path look like when life is going terribly wrong? Walton suggests six things. First, trust God rather than blame Him or make demands of Him for explanations. Trust God for strength to endure. Don't expect it all to make sense. Channel your resentment toward the fallenness of the world, not the God who has given all to initiate its redemption. Resist succumbing to the temptation to believe that you could run this world better than God does. And last of all, and above all, trust that God is wise. Now, after listing what could be construed as six steps to understanding suffering, Walton writes, "It's one thing to construct a bullet point list of theoretical strategies and advice, as that just given, those six things, but it's an entirely different matter to consider its merits when life is a mess. Does it really work?" And I think this what really sets this commentary apart and makes this the most powerful and valuable commentary on any book of the Bible that I've ever read. A woman named Kelly shares her perspective on suffering in the book of Job in the contemporary significance, the application section of each chapter of his commentary. And I want to share the most relevant parts of her very moving story. On July 29th, 2000, Kelly, then 12 years old, and her family were traveling across Nebraska from Michigan to their home in Colorado. Kelly and her sister were sleeping in the backseat of their car when suddenly I woke up to the most horrifying sound of my brother screaming and yelling profanities that I had ever heard from his mouth. I sat up just in time to see the guardrail in front of me, and then everything went black. I woke up to the sound of sirens with the world spinning around me and seven paramedics hovering 2 feet above my face. When they noticed I had regained consciousness, they shouted, "She's awake! Can you feel your toes? Can you feel your fingers? How many fingers am I holding up?" In utter confusion, I screamed, "I don't care about my toes. What happened? Who are you? Where's my family?" One paramedic lowered his voice and said, "Kelly, everyone is alive. Everyone survived." "Survived? Survived what?" I shouted, using the only energy I had left. "Your family was in a serious car accident, but everyone's okay." The car had hit a guardrail at 80 miles an hour. It had flipped over the guardrail and rolled 5 times before sliding to a stop in a cornfield. When the car impacted the guardrail, Kelly's body was catapulted through the passenger window, throwing her violently into the guardrail. And as her head smashed through the passenger window, her right shoulder collided with the frame of the car, shattering her collarbone, her right side of her collarbone, into fragments and causing the 5 main nerves there, the brachial praxis, to snap from her spinal cord. Her right arm was torn at the armpit. Her left collarbone was broken. Her liver and spleen were punctured, and all the bones on the left side of her face were broken. 1/4 of the right side of her body was paralyzed. Her sister's back was broken in several places, but she recovered fully. Her brother walked away from the accident with a cut on his shoulder, and her mother had a sprained ankle. She underwent numerous surgeries to repair the immediate damage to her young body. And then on September 11, 2000, she flew to Texas with her mother and underwent a 13-hour surgery with a top brachial plexus specialist in the country. And she recalls the operation. "They took out 2 nerves in my right legs that they told me were not completely necessary. then took out one nerve on the left side of my spinal cord and attached the two nerves to that one socket. They threaded the nerves across my chest and into my armpit, where they attached them to other nerves in my right arm. When I woke up from the surgery, I had never felt so much excruciating pain in my life. Not only did she have the pain from the surgery, but now, in addition to that, there was pain from the nerves being removed from her legs for the transplant. She says, "I remember sincerely and earnestly praying to God that he would take me home, yet the Lord had a different plan in mind." So the doctor who did the transplant surgery was hopeful that it would restore her ability to move her right arm, her right shoulder, three fingers on her right hand, but it would take 5 years to know for sure. So next she went to Canada and underwent another surgery to implant electrodes in her right arm in order to stimulate the muscles there and keep them from totally atrophying while the nerves slowly recuperated and repaired themselves. And hopefully the transplant worked. She said, at times, the pain from the nerve damage became so intense that her body would shut down and she would literally collapse. She went to a pain management specialist who implanted another electrical device that was supposed to send signals to her right arm and weaken the pain. That surgery failed. She underwent another neck surgery where they opened her vertebrae and placed electrodes along her spinal cord, ran the wires down her back, and attached them to a battery that was implanted in her lower back. That surgery also failed to lessen her pain. Another spinal surgery followed that one, and it too failed. Then in November 2007, she met with the doctor who had done the original nerve transplant. And he convinced her to undergo another spinal cord brain stem surgery. He told her, "I want you to sit here and picture life without nerve pain. Nerve pain is one of the most painful things a human body can endure. Can you remember what it feels like to live without excruciating pain?" She shook her head no. "The surgery has an 85% success rate for patients with your condition. Some wake up completely pain-free and off their pain meds. Others wake up with significantly reduced pain where the medication dose is cut in half. But there's a smaller percentage where it doesn't help, and it remains the same. Your pain remains the same. But I think it's worth a shot." When she woke up 6 hours later, she was in even more pain than she had experienced since her nerve transplant operation. Another complete failure. Then her left hand started going numb for hours at a time, and the only hand she could use was also becoming paralyzed. Fortunately, a specialist discovered a different problem and successfully corrected it, and she eventually was able to regain the use of her left arm. Kelly's story is an awful lot like Job's. She had numerous, and I've only touched the tip of the iceberg, she had numerous unsuccessful surgeries, even making her condition worse and leaving her with literally a mountain of medical bills. The amazing thing about her is that she is learning to trust God's wisdom and his goodness in spite of everything. So now let's go back to Walton's commentary on chapter 28. He asked Kelly, "As you read Job 28 and the present chapter," that is the chapter in your commentary. By the way, he met her. He was teaching Old Testament at Wheaton College, and she was one of her students, one of his students. And one of the assignments was for each student in the class is they had to pick a book of the Old Testament and write 5 papers on it, and she chose Job for obvious reasons. And so he was so riveted by her story and by her input and her feedback and her responses that she's a main part of his commentary, which I think just makes it an unbelievable resource. So he says, as you read chapter 28 and the present chapter in the commentary and reflect on the list above, which I've left up on the screen, what makes sense and what doesn't? Have any of these worked for you as you have tried to struggle through your circumstances? We would even like to know specifically which ones work and maybe which ones don't. Now, I want you to keep in mind here that these are Kelly's words that I'm going to share with you. They're not the words of a Bible scholar. Kelly, after reading Job 28, meditating on the meaning of the text, and then reading the above list, I think to myself, there's so much depth and truth in each point on the list, but how do I convey to the reader the magnitude of each step without appearing cliched? I guess I can start by stating that when I look at this list, I think every point is a great step on the path to wisdom. But so many of these points seem almost impossible without God's power. I know that if I had looked at this list in the spring of 2009, I would want to trust God and have strength, not demand an explanation, or not have resentment. But I would feel helpless and feel as though I did not have the power to do so. When you're in a place of brokenness, you desire to feel close to God, to trust Him in His will, but so many times the cycle of destructive thoughts wins the battle and brings you back to a place of frustration. Well, I shouldn't say frustration, because I was once told that frustration is a secondary emotion to either anger or sadness. So I guess it's more accurate to state that when destructive thoughts won the battle over wisdom, it brought me back to a place of sadness. So I think a key component of following these points as you seek wisdom is first and foremost to pray and ask God to help you each step of the way. Now, as cliched as that may sound, the power of prayer is vital, especially during a period of great suffering. I remember distinctly when I started healing, get back on my own two feet, while still dealing with the same trials and pain, I had to let go fully of any type of control, which also relates to point five, because it was not going to be by my strength or power that I was going to get through this. So if you're angry with God, turn to Him. Start approaching Him even in your anger. Start spending time in the Word and making time for the Lord to get to the place where you can reach the goal of point four. Channel resentment toward the fallenness of the world, not the God who has given all to initiate its redemption. So I think what makes sense to me is making point four the first point on the list. I say this because in my experience, I don't believe that you can get to a place of fully trusting God if you have not first dealt with your anger and resentment toward Him. After getting to a place where you've realized that your anger needs to be channeled toward the fallenness of your world, you can begin the process of fully trusting Him. So the process of wisdom in light of my trial started with praying for the power to do so. Praying for the power to trust God and for the strength to endure, to let go of control, and to realize you can't run the world, and praying for faith and trusting that He is wise. For me, when I'm in this process of struggling with my circumstances and trying to trust God, I've had a hard time with the second part of point one, to not make demands on Him for explanations. We know that God can bring good from our suffering, but it is important to differentiate between having hope that God has a reason and purpose and being content not knowing what that is. This is a process of simply trusting that God is good and wise rather than demanding a reason or manufacturing a reason to satisfy our desire for coherency. When our focus is solely on the pain and figuring out the trial we are in, our prayer life can become a desperate plea for escape. We can get consumed by praying for God to remove this thorn from our life instead of praying and trusting God for the strength to endure it. So I would say each point makes sense and is one that I have wrestled with throughout the process. And I think that it is important to recognize that it is a process. It is not a six easy steps to wisdom crash course. It is a continual struggle. But God does reward you with wisdom and perspective the more time you spend meditating on those things. And then Walton asks her, is there anything you could add to the list? Kelly, after thinking about my struggle to follow the path of wisdom while in the fire, I decided that a couple more points or additions might be helpful for some. I would add a second part to point three. Don't expect it all to make sense and pray for a heavenly perspective. Oftentimes, when we're in a hardship, as I mentioned before, it consumes us and our thoughts. All we see, think, or feel is related to the pain or struggle we're in. We need to take a step back and look at this experience from a wider angle view. When we come to terms with the fact that we cannot expect everything to make sense, we need to pray for a heavenly perspective to be at peace with that uncertainty, which also relates back to trusting God and His will. One other point I would add is to be sure to stay connected and spend time with godly people and or mentors. When my left arm was losing feeling and strength daily, I went through a period where I didn't want to be around my friends, mentors, or community. And it was in that period that I felt the weakest. When we're alone, we can dwell on the pain that we're experiencing and often get into a dark, downhill spiral of thoughts. God can use those people to remind you of truth and help you get out of an unhealthy thought pattern. But as we learned in Job, your friends do not always offer the best advice or encouragement. So be wise with the people you choose to play that role in your life. Let me just wrap this up by saying the trust that we are called upon to exercise is not trust that God will bring resolution or an explanation to our suffering. I don't think that's what God wants us to learn from the book of Job. Instead, I think He wants us to learn to trust in God's wisdom, to trust in His goodness and in His love, even when our experiences cause us to question those attributes. The bottom line is, trust in the wisdom of God born out of our absolute conviction that He loves us. That is the way through the struggles of life. Let's pray. Oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable His judgments and His paths beyond tracing out. Who has